This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's UKIP councillor, he's on Bradley Stoke Town Council, Ed Rose, an old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Jimmy Savile syndrome strikes again. Another establishment suspect takes his secrets to his grave. This time, it's former Tory Home Secretary Leon Britton. We asked why the police and Crown Prosecution Service failed to act on allegations about Leon Britton and ask, is Theresa May's stillborn inquiry, which was supposed to start last July, ever going to get off the ground? And is it being deliberately stalled because of fears revelations will cause the Tory party vote to collapse in May's general election? And never let it be said that one honest person can't change things. We've got a treat for Martin Summers this week because it's the US lawyer who single-handedly overturned acres of lies and myths about the underpants bomber. We hear from Kurt Haskell, who's on the flight and blew the FBI and security services plot wide open. Also, postponed from last week, we hear from Canada, the 9/11 consensus panel is planning to force a debate in the Canadian Parliament about what really happened in New York and Washington on September the 11th, 2001. We hear from Elizabeth Woodward. Plus, Martin Summers will take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 3 degrees Celsius and showers tonight. This weekend, highs of 9 degrees Celsius. Sunny and colder on Saturday, warmer but wetter on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, getting milder this week. Wet and windy weather is interspersed with sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 31st of Jan, 1st of February, highs of 5 Celsius, sunny and cold. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And now it's time to introduce our guest this week, and he's the UKIP councillor on Bradley Stoke Town Council, Ed Rose. Hi, Ed, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Oh, hi. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us about why you joined UKIP, and were you previously in a different party, Ed?
Yes, indeed. Previously, I was with the Conservative Party.
So did you get elected as a Conservative?
I was elected as a Conservative.
Well, hang on. That's a bit naughty, isn't it? People have voted for a Conservative, and you've, like a leopard, changing your spots halfway through.
Well, it isn't a question, do you change your spots or do you change where your loyalties lie? Loyalties lie with working for the community. I believe in being a public servant and felt by moving to UKIP, I was able to act more freely as a public servant to the community.
Well, that's interesting. In what way did you feel that the Conservative Party wasn't allowing you to do that?
Oh, quite easily. They had certain policies and toe the line. And if you didn't toe the line, or if you asked awkward questions, you were ostracised.
Well, hang on. Can we have some concrete examples of that? What sort of policies particularly were you trying to push and found your toes stamped on?
Well, I had a phone call at 8 o'clock in the morning from the incumbent MP who yelled at me for attending.
That's Sir Jack Lopresti.
That would be Jack Lopresti, yes. And I don't like saying his name very often because I don't want to publish him in that sense. But he called me and made a very clear statement, very rudely, I may say, also, in my opinion, about attending the airfield, the Filton airfield, where there was a march going on to raise the awareness of what would happen if the airfield was sold.
Now, this is a while back, isn't it? Was it?
This is a while back.
But 2011 or something, when were we talking about?
Yes, it is. It is about then. It was a big march. It was to raise awareness before things were actually supposedly out in the open, done and dusted. But if you lift the veneer off it, you found out that actually 2 years before, the main contractor had already made a contribution to the Conservative Party and that they were very keen that this go ahead.
Now, who is that main contractor?
Oh, I don't know the name.
Are you talking about for the housing development? Or
It was for the housing development. Okay. It was one of them in there that made, I think it was some sum of £60,000. But irrespective of that, there's a tenuous link as to what was going on. What actually came out in the review committee that was being pushed by the likes of the march was that South Gloss Council originally denied having any previous knowledge. And then under the Information Act, it came out that they actually had letters from 2 years earlier of such approach being done. So it was a bit done and dirty.
The thing is that that's come out after the event, hasn't
that's
it?
That's come out so after the event.
It's a fait accompli, basically.
It was a fait accompli, absolutely true. But irrespective of that, what was going on was this hidden agenda and the way things are done. I like things out in the open. I like to be transparent. So I ask questions in the sense of, is there any capability of saving Filton Airfield? Is there any capability of doing something else instead?
Well, hang on a minute, because it's not your airfield. It's actually owned by BAE Systems, and it's theirs to do what they want with.
My understanding of the original contract, they were supposed to be able to sell it back, and that was an option that was open, and that hadn't really been exercised its right to do that. What was trying to happen was raise the awareness that if there was alternatives, that other businesses could come in and make counter offers to South Gloss for it. Virgin, for example, were promoting an opportunity that could have had some consultation. All that was pushed aside. To stick to the point and trying to answer your question, really, why did I change, was because of the manner that was being done by people at that time of saying, there's party policy, you have to toe the line, and if you don't, that's it. You won't go anywhere, you won't do anything. And I felt, well, I have the right to ask questions as much as the public ask questions. So to have someone ring me up at 8 o'clock on a morning, Sunday morning, and tell me I'm an idiot for doing things, and if I don't follow party line to carry on, turned me off. So I made the conscious decision. I looked around, made approaches to other parties, and said, well, who seems to be the best of the bunch in making sure that you act as a public servant, trying to take politics out of it? I found UKIP, asked questions. I did meet Mr. Farage for afternoon tea. Very nice gentleman. What I liked about him, and even though he is a very succinct politician in what he says and does, he will answer the difficult questions. And I like that about him. He won't tread around. He won't tread over and give you an answer that he feels you should have. He'll answer your question.
But isn't he a closet racist?
People say that. I don't know him well enough to say that he is a closet racist. But what I found with him and what I've watched that he has been, he answers the questions. If you'd like to ask him directly that question, please be my guest. I'm sure he'll answer it in his own terms.
Well, he'll deny it, but there are quite a lot of people seem to have been gravitating towards UKIP who actually are. And that's pretty clear, isn't it?
I wouldn't say it's pretty clear. What I will say is clear, one thing, and this came out on the Andrew Marr show, that UKIP do a good exercise of sifting through their candidates. And it might take them a little while. They originally make an approach to say they want to stand. They might get elected and come in. But they're constantly under review for behaving according to the conditions that UKIP want you to
be. But isn't that exactly what you're railing against in the Conservative Party, what they were doing to you?
No, they don't tell people to toe the party line. What they're saying is, we expect you to behave as a decent human being. If you exhibit these attitudes that are unwelcome, i.e. being a racist or being a paedophile, and God knows we've got the Leon Britton case, haven't we, on the news, and that's an intimation of might be something going on there. I would wish, in the age of transparency, that when Cameron actually made the statement, oh, I'm glad to see, the same as you're asking me, you keep throwing people out, you must be a bad bunch. Well, at least we're throwing people out that are a bad bunch. We're doing the sifting. You might not catch everybody. I think you can go anywhere and say the same, but at least we're willing to say, if people aren't behaving sensibly, we're willing to push them away. We don't do cover-ups. We don't do what the latest story alleges. We don't form this big giant club and then get the police to join us and say, oh, okay, we're all chums together. That's wrong. We believe the law is the law. And part of the draw that comes into this is that people are more fervent in the way society is starting to to disintegrate, that that's the last bastion of support. You have to have the law, and you must have justice. Let's take a look at the prison systems, what's happening. We're being told they are near to collapse by the governors that run prisons, yet we're being told by the politicians there's nothing wrong. Why are there so many people in prison? You don't see all the bankers in prison for all the wrongdoings they're doing. So there seems to be one rule for one and one rule for another. What I think is good that's coming forth that you have to have is remove any form of discrimination. There's plenty of laws there already in statutes to be used, and use them. If someone breaks the law, they break the law. It doesn't matter which country you're from, what nationality or race you are, the law is clear. You should be judged fairly and judged evenly.
So do you think that there is no rule of law left then, that the people from the top levels of the establishment simply don't have to answer for their crimes?
They do answer, but they get away with it. And I'll tell you what I learnt when I was in America. The head of the United States Secret Service Treasury Division said to me on one occasion, there's two rules in the modern world. There's those crimes you can pay your way out of, and there's those crimes you can't. And it's now arrived here. And I firmly believe from what we're seeing, that seems to be the case.
OK, what were you doing chatting to the head of the American Secret Service? What were you up to?
I used to work in America. I really don't want to get into that on a radio show at this moment.
What were you doing? I mean, that's a bit about your background, isn't it? Where are you from?
It is part of that background. I used to work for a company. I used to work in profiling.
Right, so what's that? That's looking at people's character and saying, well, this is that kind of character, that's that kind of character?
That's part of it, but it's profiling the situations as well. It's profiling of a whole situation that could come up. You could do profiling of people about to buy something. You could do profile of people about to kill somebody. Minority Report. Watch that film, Minority Report, and that gives you an idea. That's the closest thing I can say.
You sound like a bit of a psychiatrist.
I do understand people. Yes, I do understand people.
What more recently have you been doing? Leave Filton aside for a minute, because
yes,
I know you've been going to some of the meetings about the Metro bus, which is an enormous controversy, actually, because just as Bristol this weekend becomes European Green Capital, we are actually in the middle of endorsing a plan which is going to be doing compulsory purchase orders of people's gardens,
yes,
and other green space,
yes,
as well as actually going driving a coach and horses right through allotments and small holdings. So this doesn't sound very green. Anyway, you've been at some of these meetings. Give us a flavour of what you've found.
Well, thank you for asking that question. That's something that's very close to my heart. I've been going to the South Gloss meetings done by the Safer Stronger committees.
Because this is something that crosses from Bristol into South Gloucestershire,
it's a bigger picture, and I'll explain that in a moment. These were specific because it was called the Metro Bus Extension. It was meant to be the extension of linking up areas that ties into the Filton airfield. Because what they're trying to do is make sure that people that live in the airfield, the new 8,000 homes, have a bus service that can get them out and across to areas that's better transport for Bristol. So they're trying to link up the railway stations. But when you go to the planning meeting and you meet people that are supposed to work in the same team, you get very different picture being painted. I attended the Bradley Stoke Safer Stronger committee meeting last night, and I actually had to raise my voice, which is sad to do, to get one of the project managers to actually admit, after a long 30 minutes of fluff, that yes, compulsory purchase would be happening, and that certain indicated areas would be losing their private space for road widening. This hasn't been so transparent. This has been very, very secretive, and it's only by probing questions that this starts to come out. The other thing that is of concern, and people listening tonight really need to be aware of and start asking the big question, is Bristol is the most congested city in Europe.
Is it?
It's won that award. So well done, Bristol. Great. But the issue really is that Bristol isn't speaking to South Gloucestershire. South Gloucestershire isn't speaking to everybody else. There should be this big unification that says transport is paramount. If you are going around and you want the boom of industry, you want a boom of people coming in, you want immigration to come in, you want to be great, you want growth, you've got to have a transport infrastructure that's united. We hear stories about Network Rail have their own plan. The bus companies have their own plan. The universities have their own plan of what they want. And then the councils have their own plan of what they want. You can't do it piecemeal. It won't work. The congestion in South Gloss already is horrendous.
Well, surely this Metro bus project, which, just to clarify, is a kind of ordinary bus, but then it goes onto these kind of guided rails, and then so it's a bit of both, basically. It's a little bit of a tram, a little bit of a bus.
Well, they promote that. What we don't see is a very clear picture.
I mean, that's going to relieve congestion of some sort, isn't it? Surely, that's the whole point, is more public transport is going to help. It's bound to.
If... let me put this way. The idea of putting it in is to relieve it. If you look at the current situation of what you've got, how is it going to do it? Because it still contends with public transport. It isn't in isolation. In parts, it will get stuck in traffic. I catch the bus. I catch number 73 bus. To get here today is taking me over 2 hours. And the reason for that is that the bus is stuck in traffic. It has partly bus lanes to zip along, but where it gets stuck in traffic, it is.
Well, this is why we've got the Metro bus, because it, hopefully, anyway, this is the theory, is it can nip out of the traffic onto one of its little guided bus lanes, maybe through the backs of some of these compulsory purchase gardens, I'm not sure, and get past the traffic.
Let's step back to the 70s. Let's take into event 1973 through 75 or 76, the big Bristol ring, where thousands of homes were compulsory purchased and left to rot for many a year. And the idea was to put a sensible transport ring around Bristol. And that's what they should have done. They should have put a proper transport ring around Bristol. They didn't. What we're trying to do now is get a clear picture of the transportation of the area, not just in isolation, it's just Bristol or it's just Bradley Stoke or a satellite township. When I speak to people that live in that area, live in another township, Patchway, for example, they feel they're in isolation. They feel they're going to be the Hartcliffe, the Yate kind of townships that used to be, that were built and promised to be this great green land, and haven't. So we've got a chance, while it's being done now, to sensibly sit down and understand how to do it properly. If they do it piecemeal, it will be a disaster, and you'll see gridlock. You'll see incredible issues.
Well, just to get some of the facts on this, I mean, they're all of the local authorities have been involved. I mean, it's not really fair for you to say it's just being done here and here. I mean, this is one project, but many local authorities. In fact, the Metro West includes reopening the Portishead line, this kind of thing. So there is some joined-up thinking.
There is some joined-up thinking, but what I'm trying to say very clearly is that the bigger picture needs to be sorted out. We're cherry-picking news that they say that there, but the big picture doesn't link up. And I can only go by the presentations that I've seen at the Safer Stronger committees by the authority, so it's them. I'm not reading it off the internet where, you know, it's people's comments. It's their presentation, and they're not painting a very clear picture.
Okay, so do you think there's been proper consultations over this?
Sometimes
what we have is we have a decision made, we're going to do this, and then they have these kind of paper consultations, and they don't take much notice, do they?
To answer that, there's a very strong drive, and a lot of people are now starting to sit up and say, it's not going to be a done deal. We will not accept a done deal. And hence coming on this show, thank you for the invite yet again, is to raise the awareness that we want people to be involved, and you have your voice in the transportation of Bristol. Because if you felt that you had a decent bus service, and if you felt you had a decent inter-domain train service, you would take those services and not be paying for parking fees? Of course you would. But the issue is, those services don't currently cover it well enough, and people take the car.
Well, you're not the only person in the city that's rather annoyed with this whole Metro bus thing.
Of course not.
I spoke earlier this week to Belinda Fawkes from Stapleton Allotments, and she's part of several groups that's been looking at why on earth the Metro bus has to go through these green areas, and so many of them.
My name's Belinda Fawkes. I have been working with various different Metro bus campaigns for over a year. I work with the Blue Finger Alliance and the Alliance to Rethink Metro Bus, and also Rising Up, which is a new collective who are looking at ways to protect land that will be impacted by Metro Bus. The Metro bus is going to have three routes running throughout the city. We are focusing on one particular part, despite the three routes damaged 28 different green spaces throughout the city. But we're focusing on one of those, alongside the M32 in Stapleton, and it covers a piece of land that is currently Stapleton allotments and small holdings. It was approved at planning last year by Bristol City Council and South Gloss Councils, and so the plans are steaming ahead. We've had recent notice that they are planning to fell lots of mature trees, including oaks and conifers and poplars, as well as a woodland copse, by the end of February this year.
No, it's all getting pretty urgent. So why are they using green space for this? I would have hoped, anyway, that you wouldn't need to be cutting down trees, certainly not allotments, that kind of thing. So, what are they up to?
They're cutting down trees, they're building over allotments and food-growing land. It's also a conservation area and greenbelt, so it's got quite a lot of statuses. What they're planning to do is build a bus-only junction or road system over this piece of land, where there will be an overbridge that will come over the M32, just past Stoke Lane.
So that's just for the bus only?
It would be only for the buses. The buses would come over the M32 on another bridge, come over into the allotments and small holdings, which will still, some of the allotments and some of the small holding land will still exist as allotments and small holdings, but they will have roads running through them and roads being built through them for the next
now,
year.
You've really surprised me by telling me that we've got small holdings in Bristol. Now, this is an amazing, I mean, they've been dying out right across the country. Many councils have been selling them off.
For the last 3 years, the Stapleton small holdings on the side of Stoke Lane have been home to an amazing project called Feed Bristol, which is an Avon Wildlife Trust community engagement food growing and wildlife project, which engages people from the local community and wider afield in all sorts of activities associated with food growing and wildlife.
Well, it sounds actually something quite good for children, particularly young people that don't have access to the countryside.
It's a fantastic space for young people. The project works with young people, it works with people particularly from deprived backgrounds and disadvantaged backgrounds, and within the last 3 years have engaged with over 25,000 people. Some of the allotments are being relocated to what is currently a wildflower meadow.
Okay, so Bango's the wildflower meadow.
Bango's the wildflower meadow, and on comes the allotments, which, you know, some of the allotments that are being lost, they are people that have been on those allotments for 30 years. They have been working the same plots, they've had the plots for generations, and they're being forced to move off those plots onto what they and a lot of other people believe will definitely be inferior soil.
Well, now, looking at the route, the bus is going to go from there up to Uey, so why can't it just go up to Junction 1 on the M32 and that seems the obvious place to go.
That definitely seems the obvious place to go, and that has been the argument from many different transport experts and many different local people and people across the board. We have been told that they have done what they call a sensitivity test, and that sensitivity test shows them that it will not be as cost effective to use that route, and it will be 3.5 minutes slower.
It's
to
all,
go
all
to
about
Junction
money.
One. So it's all about money.
And we've got Green Capital coming up, haven't we, this weekend.
And this shows you that there are some amazing green things going on in Bristol, on the ground, by people that live in Bristol. And I really want to make that really clear. There are some really fantastic things going on in Bristol, such as Feed Bristol and other projects. However, Bristol City Council have another face, and they, I believe, show incredible amounts of hypocrisy when they purport themselves to be this amazing green capital council, when they are willing to sacrifice greenbelt, conservation area, food growing land, best and most versatile soil, allotments, small holdings, community projects, and things that are really making a difference on the ground.
Well, the allotments are actually protected by law, so how have they managed to get an extinguishment
of the protection on the allotments by saying that this was for a sustainable transport system, and also not producing really clear and correct information about the quality of that land, because it's a really special piece of land. It's on what they call the Blue Finger. It's on the tip of the Blue Finger, and the Blue Finger is a finger or a strip of soil that runs for 20 kilometres from that site up into South Gloucestershire, and blue on a soil agricultural classification map denotes grade one.
What does the mayor say?
His hands are tied.
Oh, come on, George.
The mayor says his hands are tied, and the mayor is unwilling to step up and actually do something about this. He says he will be sued by South Gloucestershire Council. If he were to do this, because of a legal agreement that has been signed. I will not tell you the disappointment that local people have felt at George Ferguson's
response to this. It's a bit naughty saying, I'm sorry, I can't have an opinion. You're the mayor, George.
He's the mayor, and he holds the budget for Bristol. So this is a Bristol project. I went to London and spoke to the Department of Transport. I spoke to the ministers. I spoke to Baroness Kramer, who is actually kind of heading the Department of Transport on the funding for this. They told us that nobody from Bristol City Council, including George Ferguson, has ever talked to them about issues about this route, and they would be very willing to listen to them if they did. However, there has been silence.
It's a bit naughty, kind of abrogating responsibility, really, especially since it's supposed to be Green Capital Year. Not very green to run coach and horses through Stapleton allotments.
Absolutely.
And feed Bristol.
So one of the huge concerns surrounding the Metro bus, the three routes and this particular part of the North Fringe to Hengrove package, are the spiralling costs. So the Metro bus is partially funded by the government, but this funding is capped at a certain amount. That amount will not rise. The costs of all of these routes and the different aspects of the routes are spiralling. At the moment, for the North Fringe to Hengrove package, the entire route will cost £100 million. 50 of that will be paid for by the government. The rest is split between Bristol and South Gloss. In 2011, Bristol was going to be paying £20 million towards this route. And in 2014, they were down to be paying £25 million. So that's been a rise of £5 million.
Okay, so what are we getting for our money? Is this really going to ease congestion?
It's really not seen as being a strong transport solution for Bristol. We are going to get what is most probably normal diesel buses running down a lot of just normal roads through Bristol. Some of them will be guideways.
I seem to remember this was originally sold as a kind of eco bus thing.
It was supposed to be eco bus. It was sold as being kind of, you know, low emissions, environmentally friendly buses, but it has since come to light that these routes will be tendered out to companies, and the companies will decide which kind of bus they will use, and the likelihood is that there'll be diesel buses.
A bit annoying to have a green project that runs right through allotments and small holdings. Pretty irritating. Belinda Faulks from Rising Up in Stapleton. Let's hope you don't have to rise up too much until you get your way, Belinda. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Belinda Faulks, as you heard. Now I'm joined in the studio by Ed Rose, who's Bradley Stoke Town Council UKIP councillor. So you're certainly not the only one on this particular topic. How green actually is it? Because, I mean, we're hearing a lot of damage happening on the ground, but actually it's going to overall relieve congestion. And as you pointed out before Belinda started there, Bristol is like the top of the congestion scale in Europe. So no wonder we need to be doing schemes like this. And you're bound to go through some green spaces, aren't you?
In answering that question, possibly. I don't know. I haven't been part of the planning or seen or all of the planning. I'm speaking up now because I'm only catching the tail end when the community is starting to hear the first stories that's been released by the authority, and that's the authority of South Gloucestershire. I haven't been involved with Bristol's part. I'm concerned for my area because from Bradley Stoke to Bristol City Centre, if you take the X73, it's a good hour and a half to get into Bristol. I could be in London at the same time. If I take the standard 73 bus to get to the city centre in the morning rush hour, that takes a good 2 hours. Now, I used to go in to come in to look around in Bristol. It's a nice city to be in, you know, and to take 4 hours of travelling out of a day. Well, imagine the people that are supposed to live in the satellite of Bristol, Bradley Stoke, and go to work. It's horrific. Absolutely horrific, that timescale. So what you want and welcome is a scheme such as this that looks at it. But my fear is, and it's based on what I have heard and the way the questions have been answered, is that the comprehensive getting together of the people that are involved in these various partitions of the schemes are not speaking to each other. And my fear is that it will be done as a part here or done as a part there. And then when it comes to 2017, when Network Rail has its time to come along and says, we want to upgrade all the bridges, it's too little too late.
OK, so let's go to Westminster now to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. And there were lots and lots of questions. I think it was about five questions all about the Chilcot inquiry and whatever has happened to this inquiry into the Iraq war. Before we hear that, let's hear from Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers on this, because there's lots of accusations around the world. Indeed, in Malaysia, I think, there has actually been a trial as to whether Tony Blair and George Bush committed war crimes by going into Iraq and whether that was an illegal war. So why is that simply the answer as to why Chilcot hasn't come out, because it's just a giant cover-up?
Well, I mean, basically, inquiries are designed to kick things into the long grass and to keep them there.
But aren't they designed to actually find out what really happened?
No,
and to publish.
Really.
And then when this report is published, we will know what really happened. We'll see these secret memos, won't we?
Well, we will, but we've already... A lot of it has been already
I
been
suppose
leaked.
I should say if, not when.
Yeah, a lot of it's already been leaked. And let's face it, lots of people have already made their minds up on this. They know what their views are. The inquiry will not change much one way or the other, I don't suppose.
So you don't think it needs to be released?
Well, it should. When you've instituted an inquiry, they should definitely report. They're not reporting, obviously, because various toes don't need to be trodden. It'll be toes in America as much as in Britain. I mean, the objections were coming from Bush and his acolytes saying, we don't want our private conversations in your report.
But, I mean, they've had this in the States with the CIA torture report. There's a lot of pressure on them not to publish that report.
That's right.
But they just published it. Why
well,
so long?
They published it with redactions.
Why so long for Chilcot?
Well, because basically, as you put it in a nutshell, the accusation is that Bush and Blair are war criminals and should go to The Hague. That's quite a difficult whitewash to whitewash,
okay,
isn't it?
Okay, well, my choice of the questions at Prime Minister's questions this week is from the father of the House, the Conservative MP, Sir Peter Tapsell.
Does my right honourable friend fully recognise the contrast inefficiency between the inquiries into the Crimean War and the Dardanelles campaign? But when compared with the disgraceful incompetence of the Chilcot inquiry into widely held suspicions that Mr. Blair conspired with President George W. Bush several months before March of 2003, and then systematically sought to falsify the evidence on which that action was taken.
Well, I obviously bow to the father of the House's knowledge about these previous inquiries. I would say the one thing all three have in common is I'm not responsible for the timing of any of them. The truth is, it is extremely frustrating that this report cannot come out more quickly, but the responsibility lies squarely with the inquiry team. It is an independent inquiry. It would not be right for the Prime Minister to try and interfere with that inquiry, but I feel sure when the inquiry does come out, it will be thorough and it will be comprehensive. But let me repeat again, if the Labour Party had voted for this inquiry when we first put it forward, the inquiry would be out by now.
On the inquiry. Well, it's interesting that you have these inquiries. I agree with my colleague here that they are a mechanism to take a long-standing review of spin and how it can be presented in the best light. A lot of these things are covered under the Official Secrets Act, whether it's by the USA or the UK, that have sometimes a 100 years or 200 years D notice on it. So it's going to be for historians to eventually find out, if it ever gets released in its full term, of what really went on.
So what's the point of the Chilcot if what you're saying is there's all this umming and ahhing by lawyers over months and months and years about whether X and Y evidence that's been presented is allowed to be shared with the public?
Well, it's one of those things that you answer. It's the same as you asked the question earlier. Is Nigel Farage a racist? You can have an inquiry into that. And that might take 20 years for someone to look at it. You can go along and ask a question and hope for something to come out of it. The lawyers play with it. The politicians play with it. The background boys and girls that make up the reports play with it. And try and bring it together. If you had a real honest-to-goodness independent inquiry, I'm sure the guilt would be far wider than just those two gentlemen.
Isn't it just rather like the child sexual abuse inquiry? Is the whole idea is to keep it down because there's a general election in the offing?
Correct. I, in my own personal opinion, I think some of these inquiries do more damage than good. What they do is they dampen it because they fall on that excuse of you can't have any answers until the inquiry's finished.
Well, we've had three general elections, it seems, as we're being told, it's not going to be published until after May, since the inquiry started. How many do you need until you can actually publish something?
Well, if you have a if UKIP comes in, I'd like to think that Nigel Farage would actually say we'll push this along because we do like transparency and we do believe law and order and those who commit a crime should be punished.
Well, also, Martin, it's taken months apparently to send out draft sections of the report to those who've been criticised and also to give them a right to reply before the final version is published. The suspicion in Whitehall is that the inquiry could have been completed before the May election if Sir John had got his skates on.
Yeah, all right. Well, I'll make a comment on this, which I can't give my source for this, because my source is a secret source. But this source is telling me that the Brown brought the inquiry in basically rattled the keys of number 10 at Blair and said, we know that you knew that the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were not what you said they were, but were in fact missing South African and US warheads, which had gone missing. The US warheads had gone missing during the first Gulf War, and the South African warheads had been bought by a cabal of top Tories, I have the names, and sold on to the British government as a profit both to themselves and to the Tory party of £17.8 million.
Is this question which was asked by Doug Hoyle, I think?
Yes, Doug Hoyle asked a question. It's in Hansard. Said, where did the Conservative Party get this £17.5 million, which was paid over by General Wild Boar Smith on the Bank of Jersey into the coffers of, just before the 92 election? And my information is that that money came from the proceeds of a company called Astra Holdings, which was headed by an ex-MI6 agent called Stephen Cock. They approached Arms Corps, bought three of the warheads that the South Africans had already produced, and then sold them on to the British government as a profit for decommissioning. And therefore, the party itself and individuals made money. The stink in the tail being that they then the person they were dealing with, John Bredenkamp and Billy Reutenbach, who are ex-Rhodesian SAS people based in the Mendips here, they double-crossed the cabal that was doing this. And the weapons went missing. Now, this whole story of the missing nuclear weapons from the Middle East is, I'm reliably informed by my informant, one of the reasons why they can't get the Chilcot report straightened out. Now, I leave that to the listeners judge whether
also,
how accurate or inaccurate.
I think I should put a caveat on that these are just allegations.
They are. But the sources are very. I've been talking to this person for a number of years. I can't give their name, but they inform me that this is the story underpinning the Chilcot.
And what about David Cameron? To get back to this, because what he's saying is, I can't actually get this thing published. It's really basically he's washing his hands of it, isn't he?
Well, you mentioned David Cameron. Cameron. David Cameron comes into this story because he was part of the cabal that bought these nuclear
now,
weapons.
Now, what year are we talking about?
So we're
roughly?
Talking about 1989.
Allegedly.
No, he did definitely make a trip to South Africa in the company of Sir Kenneth Warren, who's a major Tory fundraiser, and also Dr. David Kelly, who was the weapons
expert. Martin, it's only an allegation that came back with luggage tags for nuclear weapons from South Africa.
No,
I don't think that's necessarily.
This is the allegation that's been relayed to me in great detail over a number of years, and this is an opportunity for me to mention it.
Okay.
So I've mentioned it.
All right. Well, let's move on again to Prime Minister's questions, and this one is from Mary Glyndon about Low Pay Britain, which was an excellent dispatches programme which was broadcast on Monday.
This is Mary Glyndon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This week, Channel 4's dispatches did an excellent job in exposing the reality of life for millions of people in low-paid, part-time and insecure work. Can't the Prime Minister see that his failure to promote decent jobs with decent pay is still a fundamental problem for our economy?
Say to the Honourable Lady is if she looks at the figures, she will see that 8 out of 10 of the jobs created in the last year are full-time jobs. Now, I know the Labour Party comes here trying to make a case, but I'm afraid all the evidence has moved away from you. Originally it was said no jobs would be created. We now see more people in work than ever in our history. Then we were told all the jobs would be part-time. You can now see the majority are full-time jobs. Then we were told the jobs wouldn't pay more than inflation, and you can now see wages rising ahead of inflation. And of course, helping that is the cuts in income tax that we've made to help people who are low paid and to take them out of income tax altogether. That is the programme we're pursuing. There's not an ounce of complacency because there's a lot more work to do, but we are on the right track.
Well, it took David Cameron quite a lot of swerving there to get around what that Dispatches documentary on Monday was explaining about the conditions and pay and conditions of many of the workers in modern Britain, because it ain't much point in massively increasing the number of people unemployed if they then can't pay the bills. So before we hear from our guests, let's have a listen to a couple of clips from that Dispatches programme, and we start with one about, actually it's somebody called Russell Bloor, who was unemployed, but then he found himself self-employed, but he wasn't getting a lot of work.
This is Russell Bloor, and he's counted as one of our great British entrepreneurs. Early last year, he was unemployed, but then he turned his hobby into his job and set up his own business. He's now his own boss, taking photos of up-and-coming Manchester bands. Sounds great.
At the moment, not much going on, I have to be honest. It's something coming up in a couple of weeks is the next definite thing on. There's no regular income, so the last solid lump of money I got was 40 quid for doing a local band. And then I sold a print the other day, which I made about 10 quid on.
So you started this business up 8 months ago. What's been your turnover?
Probably 250 odd.
250 quid?
Roughly.
In 8 months? That's not sustainable. It's not anything, is it?
Not really, no.
Russell says his job centre advisor put him on a government business startup scheme after he mentioned an interest in photography. Next, a company called Blue Orchid helped him write a business plan. Now, Russell's lack of success shouldn't come as much of a surprise to them. Here's what Russell wrote. Weaknesses: no business experience, extremely limited finances, money or lack of is going to be the main issue. And the strengths? There were none. Even so, his plan was still signed off, and Russell was officially in business.
Well, that sounds very, very familiar. And, of course, Blue Orchid will have been paid good taxpayers' money to sign him into being a self-employed nobody. And, of course, he then comes off the figures as unemployed.
That sounds almost like a bribe to get somebody off the figures.
Well, it is. I mean, effectively, that's what's going on. Can I just make a practical point? The economy grew to the size it was before the crash about 18 months ago. A year ago. And at that time, as the Prime Minister pointed out, there are more people in work in Britain than ever before. That doesn't mean much because, of course, the population rises. But the fact is that means it's a logical point, not a political point. Those jobs must be low productivity jobs. There can't be anything else. So what we're doing is we're specialising in this country in cheap and cheerful. But out there in the real world, Bangladesh is cheaper and cheerful, more cheerful than we are. We need to look at countries like Norway, which have had planned capitalist economies run by socialist governments since the war. That could have been us. It isn't. Why not?
Okay, before we hear from Ed, we're going to have another clip from this Dispatches Low Pay Britain. And this was looking at ultra part-time work.
Some workers are ultra part-time, like Lee Masson from Cumbria, who is guaranteed just a few hours every week.
You're only contracted for 7.5 hours a week.
Yeah, 3 hours and 45 minutes on Saturday, 6 a.m. till 9:45, Saturday and Sunday.
But you're getting up, getting out of bed, coming into work for what, 3 and a bit hours?
Yeah, it's hard to motivate yourself to get up that early when that's all you're going in for.
Lee says he's asked for more guaranteed hours, but Tesco turned him down. But when they ask him to work extra shifts, he says he can be disciplined if he says no.
If they give you 24 hours notice, you have to do it. But if it's less than 24 hours, you can say no.
No doubt these contracts suit some people. And for Tesco, hiring part-timers gives managers a lot of flexibility if, say, someone calls in sick. But it also means Tesco pays less tax. Every little helps.
Now, here's the thing. If you're earning less than £153 a week, it means that the company is not making any employer's national insurance contributions.
And that can mean massive savings. Something that former HR director for Morrisons, Norman Pickavance, knows all about.
It's a huge amount of money for every person that they have on this kind of contract. You're talking about a reduction in the order of 14% per worker, so it's a huge benefit.
Across the country, we estimate this could save Tesco as much as £100 million a year.
Thing is, it may not just be the taxman losing out, but workers too. To qualify for a full state pension, you need to have made 30 years of national insurance contributions. If you're working part-time and not earning enough to make those NI contributions, well then you may end up with a lower state pension or none whatsoever.
Well, it's a bit frightening, isn't it, to think that you may be in work according to the figures, and yet actually when you come to the end of your working life, you're going to be totally stony broke with no pension whatsoever, not even a state pension. So let's just get a reaction from Ed Rose, UKIP councillor at Bradley Stoke Town Council, on that.
Well, let me give you an example from Bradley Stoke. There's a company up there that subcontracted to work for the NHS, and they run the telephone hotline where you ring in, that's not the 999 service. They take people in and say, we'd like to have some sense of medical training, but have no medical training. Go on a course and learn how to use an American system that's a question and answer system that helps you make a decision whether or not to call an ambulance or take some aspirin and go there, there, there.
Are you talking about the 111 service?
It's the 111 service. I didn't remember the number.
Okay.
Thanks for that. And what's wrong with this is that people, and you've seen it happen, and I'll explain why I'm upset at it. And it's another thing I'm trying to investigate and get brought out into the open in the age of transparency, is that this organisation puts these people in through a training course, and it says to them that you, the person on the phone, is the person liable if anything goes wrong. And that you personally can be sued. Not us, the American company. Not us, the American company, have such a bad record of labour that we were kicked out of the United States and operate from the Philippines. How did they end up here? More to the point, what you said earlier is that the people they take on board are on a zero contract employment. Well, what do you say to these people? We'll tell you when you can work. We'll give you a short notice of your hours. Your hours are from zero to whatever we want, when we want. And if you don't turn up, we'll discipline you. Now, if you go to DWP and you say, whoopee-doo, I've got a job working on the 111 line, but I might only work 5 hours this week, DWP doesn't care. DWP says you're in employment as far as we're concerned, because you have the opportunity to work more than 16 hours. And as soon as that's the case, you're off the books. As soon as you're off the books, and the way South Gloss Council works, if you're not getting any assistance from unemployment, whichever it is, unemployment or JSA, depending on your stamp situation, South Gloss won't help you. So you are literally on skid row. You are begging for the hours that company will give you, or whatever else it needs. What's wrong with this? And I don't understand why nobody in the Conservative government that are up there talking about a greater Britain don't challenge this. Why? They're all pro-Europe. Is that a yes, Conservatives? Yes, you're pro-Europe.
What's, hang on, what's this got to do with Europe? This is Britain.
There's labour laws. If they're pro-Europe, there's labour laws in effect from Europe. They're being breached by the zero-hour contracts. Let's remove that, as you say. Let's forget about Europe. And a state led by Germany. There was actually a statement by Hitler back in the 30s. So, you know, it's come to bite us in the backside. But take a look at our sovereignty, the great British sovereignty. All that was done through the decades to create the Factories Acts, they are still in effect. So why are you allowing a situation that breaks the Factories Acts, first, our sovereignty, that breaks the European rules and regulations on employment, so these companies can come along, take people, have them in a situation where they can be berated, disciplined, thrown out like garbage at a moment's notice, for pence on the hour?
Well, you make a very good case, and I agree with you, but I often wonder, well, why were you ever in the Conservative Party, and what is the position of UKIP on these matters? Because the real wages in the reality is that real wages stopped rising with productivity in the developed capitalist world in the mid 70s. So if you look at the productivity growth in the economy, which is usually runs ahead because of technological change at about 3% a year, In the golden age of capitalism, that was redistributed through to the workers through pay increases year on year. And that, of course, has led to the prosperous consumer society in which we grew up, which is fast disappearing for vast swathes of the population. Once the breaking of the unions in Britain was part of a general policy all over the world to change the balance of power in the labour market, and they got what they wanted, mm-hmm. and then they had a boom, inverted commas, on the back of that, which is a massive asset price rise. But, of course, you then go back to the 19th century, where it's not inflation that gets you, it's boom and bust. You hit the wall and mm-hmm. bang. And, of course, that's exactly what's happened.
Well,
ultimately, we've got another story here about the wealth being concentrated in the hands of a tiny minority. This process has led to that happening. And actually, capitalism works best with a strong redistributive element in it.
Well,
you allow capitalism to run, you let some people get bigger than others, you don't try and cut everybody down to the same size, but like a game of darts, once in a while you just wipe the board and you put some money back in at the bottom. And we've stopped doing that about a generation ago.
And you know who stopped doing it, Martin? It's the people who are now at Davos, 1,700 private jets.
Well, they're the ones
they're
who
the
force
1%,
the...
They're the 0.001%.
But they're the ones who provide the funds for the politicians, which is a huge problem. All politicians, if they want to go anywhere, do need resources, and these are the guys with the resources.
But at the other end of the scale, this is an article in The Independent from Tuesday the 30th of December. The number of evicted tenants is soaring, the Ministry of Justice figures show. A surge in evictions is blamed by Labour on the failure of wages to keep pace with rent increases, as well as the introduction of so-called bedroom tax. County court bailiffs repossessed nearly 41,200 properties on behalf of landlords in the 12 months to September. Labour, which released an analysis of the Ministry of Justice figures, said it's estimated 90,000 people were evicted. This is the highest figure that since records began.
Let the record speak for itself is what I say on that. It is pretty disgusting. What you see is a constant rise. In Bradley Stoke, there's a constant rise. My own rent's being put up. It used to be £6.75, it's now £7.25, and I'm just supposed to absorb that, as well as all the other price rises that go on in that situation. What happens?
Another statistic to add to all this, because sometimes I think there's not enough statistics about just how much pain there is at the bottom, where we see the coverage of Davos and all the world's media looking at all these wonderful private jets and everything. But, for example, in London, 4 in 10 cases of homelessness is due to eviction. So it seems like this is a growth industry.
It is a growth industry. And I'll point both of you and the listeners, take a look at America. You take a look at America in the 60s and 70s, and what's great, Kojak's on. I love Kojak. But take a look at the scenes behind. Take a look at what New York looked like. Take a look at the homeless. Take a look at the way certain parts of our country is looking very similar to that. People are out hanging around on the street. If they can't get work, idle hands for the devil is what comes of this. What's sad about it is that you take a look at the way mortgages have been out of reach for so long. People are forced to go into rented accommodation and are actually paying more money than they would if they had a mortgage.
Okay, so what should we do about it? Come on, Ed. If you're sitting in the driving seat, what would you do?
I would say people need to start to look into the banks doing more in this avenue of being working for local communities, local care, and doing something that banks were designed to do.
That's not going to happen, surely, because the banks just do what's good for them, which is making money. In fact, printing it. You know, we're in the situation now, we've just announced, Martin, haven't we, this week, 1.1 trillion quantitative easing. Now, you said it would never happen.
No.
But it is happening. You were predicting that. You were saying, I don't think they'll do it.
The Germans
But the point being that this is actually counterfeiting this printing money. They're making, it's probably the biggest counterfeiting heist operation that Europe's ever seen.
Well, it's not just Europe, it's all over the world.
No, Britain's been doing it, and America has.
We've been doing it for years. The Europeans are just taking their first first gateway drug here.
But surely counterfeiters get arrested, don't they? They go to trial and then they go to jail.
This is a fundamental problem, is that the financial sector is actually way, way out of control. And because of quantitative easing, the asset prices of the asset-owning classes have been not just protected, but boosted by what's happened. So that's why they're not keen at all. There is no crisis in Davos. The crisis is how we're going to carry on getting away with this. There's an air of unreality about this general election, because all the major parties, and including UKIP, nobody really wants to say, well, actually, and I say it every week, as you know, Tony, the banks are going to collapse properly.
Well, you cannot rescue
them through state intervention.
Actually, there is some very good news on the cost of living this week. That is gas prices coming down. Ed Rose from Bradley Stoke, UKIP councillor, what do you make of that?
Well, for those that have gas, great. There are certain areas in the area I live in, there isn't any gas. It's all electric. So I like to see it across the range that says where you're dependent on energy, that you get a fair price for it. I'm not sure, because if you look at the Go Compare sites and look across, in the end, you seem to be paying more. I'm not an expert on this or an economist to actually work it out, but my feeling is that we are paying way above the rate on power supplies. And one of the things about electricity company that came to light that I disagree with in my own opinion was that they said, we need to make investments, so we're overcharging you, so we actually build up a backlog of money to make the investment. But my answer to that is, well, hang on a minute, isn't that what shares are all about? That you actually go to public offering and say, we want to raise capital so we can advance. You become part of the big picture by shares.
Martin, the gas price came down, we're told, about 25% last year. But these price reductions are only 5% or 3.5%.
Well, there is a reason why these industries were taken into the public sector at the end of World War II. And we were talking earlier about the mess in transport policy. The fragmentation of the bus industry by the Conservative governments in the 1980s, the deregulation of the financial markets, the creation of Al-Qaeda to fight in Afghanistan, these are Thatcher's poisonous legacies, which we are going to choke on and possibly die.
Okay, a final story on that cheerful note. A final story, Trident. I mean, I had to bring this in because this is a massively, incredibly expensive project, £100 billion project. Was discussed, debated by the House of Commons this week, and everyone seemed to vote for it, apart from the fringe parties and Plaid Cymru, people like that. Labour Party voting with them, Martin, for £100 billion to spend on renewing Trident. Now, surely we can't afford that. That's ridiculous.
I'm sure the usual rebels will have voted against the government against the party policy on this.
Nick Clegg and Ed Miliband didn't cast a vote, Ed.
Well, I think they're all playing safe. I spent my time in the military and I worked on NBC, which is nuclear, bacteriological and chemical warfare. And the situation is that spending this much money on an old, tried and tested system of we're going to nuke you till you glow doesn't get anyone anywhere. I'd rather see that they spent the money on conventional warfare that's more like what we see that's going on in urban situations.
But Trident's going rusty, isn't it?
It is going rusty.
There's no nuclear deterrent, have you?
Well, who are you deterring against?
Good question. Martin?
Well, presumably Vladimir Putin, but even so, it's not really going to work, is it? I mean, there isn't really a military case for Trident. It's just a kind of... The political case is having nuclear weapons means we have a vote on the Security Council.
OK, well, that's time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, UKIP councillor on Bradley Stoke Town Council, Ed Rose. After the Murdoch News, we look at the 9/11 consensus panel getting 9/11 debated in the Canadian Parliament.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol.